Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. When I teach storytelling to organizations, I often say that the most powerful communications to reach both hearts and minds combine story and data. Actually, what I say is a really compelling human story and some maybe shocking, eye-popping, memorable data. Well, these are the words of today's guest, David Goldhill. My dad became a statistic, merely one of the roughly 100,000 Americans whose deaths are caused or influenced by infections picked up in hospitals. 100,000 deaths, more than double the number of people killed in car crashes, five times the number killed in homicides, 20 times the total number of our armed forces killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. After his father's death, David Goldhill, an entertainment industry executive, began a personal exploration of the healthcare industry. His September 2009 cover story in The Atlantic rocked the healthcare world. Now Goldhill has written a book expanding on the article, Catastrophic Care: How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. It is a system he argues that is not worth preserving in anything like its current form, asserting that Obamacare will not fix it, and he offers his own radical solution. Before we get started, let me offer some more data. As a nation, we now spend almost 18% of our GDP on healthcare, almost $1 in $5. In 1966, Medicare and Medicaid made up 1% of total government spending. Now that figure is 20%. The federal government spends 8 times as much on healthcare as it does on education, 12 times what it spends on food aid to children and families, 30 times what it spends on law enforcement. For every 2 doctors in the U.S., there is now 1 health insurance employee, more than 470,000. In 2006, it cost almost $500 per person just to administer health insurance. Of the 52 industries represented on Fortune's 2007 list, pharmaceuticals and medical equipment ranked 3rd and 4th, respectively, in terms of profits as a share of revenue. From 2000 to 2007, the annual profits of America's top 15 health insurance companies increased from $3.5 billion to $15 billion. Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative and provocative approaches to business, environment, science, health, politics, economics, culture, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better and I want to find out how. David Goldhill is president and chief executive officer of GSN, which operates a U.S. cable television network and is one of the world's largest digital games companies. He's a member of the board of directors of the Leapfrog Group, an employer-sponsored organization dedicated to hospital safety and transparency. Goldhill graduated from Harvard with a BA in history and holds an MA in history from New York University. Catastrophic Care is his first book. Welcome, David Goldhill, to Pacifica and Free Forum.
Hi, Terrence. Thank you for having me today.
You're very welcome. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, so I want to start with the story. What happened to your father?
Well, my dad was 82 years old and had what looked like the onset of a respiratory illness, possibly pneumonia. Checked himself into a hospital for really antibiotics and oxygen, and within 24 hours acquired what became a series of infections from the hospital that 5 weeks later killed him. You know, when you go through something like that, there's a number of things you notice even through all the difficulty. And one is just the shock of having somebody be essentially healthy one day and desperately clinging for life the next. But I think the other is just how in this life or death situation where there's so much pressure and anxiety, things are so different than what we see anything else in our life. There's an extraordinary amount of mistakes you see being in a hospital. The very fact that your physician will tell you it would be best if there's a family member with him at all times in an extraordinary high-tech institution in our day and age is in itself an admission of the problems in hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
When after my father died, I would say it was a few weeks, 4 or 5 weeks later, that I read an article that Atul Gawande had written about a doctor who was running around the country and trying to convince hospitals to adopt a series of relatively simple protocols that would greatly reduce, not eliminate, but greatly reduce the number of hospital deaths, and that the number a year was estimated at around 100,000. And I think a number of things sort of felt just absolutely strange to me. One is that number, 100,000, is an extraordinary number of deaths, and I think the estimates for total medical error deaths in the system beyond hospitals is up near 200,000.
Right.
It's one of the major causes of death we have. The second is how relatively easily preventable many of these were, and the third was, yet there didn't seem to be enough energy, incentive, reason to do it. And so a lot of my work has been about why is it that as people, as patients, as citizens, we're willing to give the healthcare system a pass on this and a variety of other things that we would never accept in anything else in our life. And that's kind of the question that I've asked and that the book that I've written, Catastrophic Care, tries to answer in, I think, a very different way than the way people have looked at healthcare before.
I want to add one other thing that you mentioned, that 10 days after or so after your father's death, you saw that article by Atul Gawande. And I interviewed Atul on that book, and so we will talk about that a little bit more. But you also say that 10 days after your father's death, the hospital sent your mother a copy of the bill for his five-week stay, and I'm going to read this part here. $636,687.75. Yeah, $636,000. $11,590 per night for the ICU room, $7,400 per night for a semi-private room before he was moved to the ICU, $145,000 for drugs, $42,000 for respiratory services. Even the most casual effort, I'm still quoting David Goldhill, even the most casual effort to compare these prices to marginal costs or to the cost of off-the-shelf components demonstrates the absurdity of these numbers. But why should my mother care? Her share of the bill was $992. The balance, undoubtedly at some huge discount, was paid by Medicare. So I just want to put that out there too. That's the other piece of what's so insane. Not only do we give them a pass, but as you point out, we pay them, and we pay them very, very well, even when they fail.
Yes, and I think that's fundamentally, you know, what my book is about. It's not about kind of a villain approach to understanding healthcare. I think almost everybody I've met in healthcare is dedicated to making patients' lives better, dedicated to health as a broad concept. So the sort of political process of looking for villains to blame is less interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
What I think structurally is interesting is, and I say this as a parent of a kid who just was in a hospital as well as a business person, is that the incentives in the healthcare system are so perverse that, exactly as you point out, essentially killing my father is an activity that you can be paid for. And that's really just the most egregious of what is a series of incentives that I think is the fundamental explanation for why prices are so high in an industry that technology should have significantly reduced costs in, why there's so much excess medicine, why the customer service is worse than you will see in any other type of service that deals with consumers, and why the quality is often so erratic that very large numbers of people are harmed and even killed.
Very good. That's the voice of David Goldhill. I'm Terrence McNally. David's an entertainment industry executive, but he is also the author of Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. Okay, so we've set up the event, as we both know from screenwriting, the inciting incident which sets you off. And what did you do then? I'm going to read one quote from that you've said. My survivor's grief has taken the form of an obsession with our healthcare system.
Well, I think it feels a little bit like Alice in Wonderland, to use perhaps a bit of an overused metaphor. If you're a business person who's outside the healthcare industry and you look how things are done in healthcare, almost everything is a shock to you, from the ultimate customer having no idea what anything costs, to often providers having no idea what anything costs, to the extraordinary amount of excess care in which the benefit to the patient is barely considered, and this is particularly a problem among our seniors, to the just fundamental lack of accountability. I mean, what the book talks about is what I call the island of healthcare, where we seem to believe, and I by the way, I think we believe this as a general rule, that healthcare is so different from everything else that we've got to give it a pass. It's got to be more complicated. It's got to be one of those very few industries where technology is driving up cost. Accidents have got to be inevitable. And what the book basically argues is the reason healthcare is an island is because we've insisted on making it an island. In fact, we can do a lot of things to build into it the type of accountability we see in everything else, and that our model for understanding healthcare is fundamentally outdated. This is no longer urgent and rare. This is integrated into every aspect of our lives, and we're not going to be able to long-term to manage it as if it's the equivalent of our house burning down. And that's kind of fundamental to what I'm saying, is that when you look at the island of healthcare and look at the mainland, the differences are so enormous that I reject the argument that those enormous differences are because healthcare just has to be so different.
Right. As a matter of fact, as I was reading your work, I found myself thinking about one other industry that has some similarities, and that's defense. In other words, both are run through the government, both are enormous, and both seem to lack the checks and balances. We've heard for years about the huge, the crazy things of the $1,000 hammer or the $1,000 toilet, those sorts of things, and all of the cost overruns and et cetera, in defense. And it seems like what you're showing people is, healthcare, which is so much closer to each of us, seems to suffer from a lot of the same.
Terrence, I think that's a really good comparison. And I think one element of that comparison that's important, in addition to the ones you mentioned, is that in defense, there's essentially one buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means is that the sellers, the buyer can't relate to the sellers the way we do in everything else. We go and buy a tube of toothpaste. We want to buy the cheapest brand we like. There's a lot of considerations that go into that. But in defense, when you decide what airplane to buy, you have to consider that if you buy from only one supplier, the other guy's going to go out of business. You're essentially a partner of the suppliers in defense as the single buyer. And I think if you look at healthcare regulation, particularly hospital regulation, but also drug company regulation, the government is now a direct buyer of roughly half of healthcare, and is in a more complicated regulatory relationship with the suppliers than I'd like to see. I think it's one of the reasons that we don't have the same degree of transparency in hospital safety we do in aircraft safety. Because to some extent, if Medicare hadn't, for example, paid that hospital for my father's care or miscare, it would view itself as simply having to pay more for someone else's care. At the end of the day, Medicare needs that hospital to stay open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that way it's similar to defense.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. And my mind also goes, and all the too big to fail stuff going on Wall Street, it's different, but there's some similarity there where they become partners. What I also wanted to get a little bit, David, when I asked that question about what happened when you became obsessed, was not just the principles you found out, but you've got a busy life. You've got a family. You're an executive. Enough on your plate already. I'm asking for your personal what happened to you personally and what you undertook.
Well, one of the great things about being interested in healthcare is that 310 million of us have a healthcare story, and many of us have multiples. And what's interesting is if you approach it from the perspective of the patient consumer, and you talk to anyone, you raise a subject about anyone, they've got a story. And if you listen to enough of these stories from friends and people you meet and people who are interested in your work, it helps you start developing a framework for researching things, I think, in a very different way than others do. And so a lot of what I did was just ask people their healthcare story. And of course, you hear everything from the, relatively mundane but still frustrating, my doctor lost my file, my GP didn't talk to the specialist before I went to see the specialist, I was kept in a hospital waiting room for 8 hours, to the, more tragic, the amount of medical harm and even death caused by mistakes is extraordinary. When my dad was in the hospital, he was twice taken for procedures meant for other patients, and we had to intervene and, you know, that doesn't happen that often at a dry cleaner or FedEx anymore. There's no reason for it to happen.
Right. It doesn't even happen at car servicing.
Your auto mechanic has had no problem adjusting to electronic records.
That's right.
Your hospitals have. But I think, so in terms of a personal exploration, what I've always tried to focus on is not the theoretical aspects of healthcare, which I think dominate the debate, as if by changing a rule, suddenly good things will happen in response to the rule, but what healthcare really looks like to patients, and to look at patients as consumers and say, what is it, what explains why there are no electronic records? What explains why you're waiting in your doctor's waiting room, but if you need cosmetic surgery, that cosmetic surgeon's not going to keep you waiting?
Mm-hmm.
What are the explanations, what I call the little picture? What are the explanations, the structural explanations for why we experience these things in a way that we don't in anything else? And so that's really been the focus. It's been asking a question that I think is rarely asked in healthcare, where the debate tends to be about big picture issues, insured versus uninsured.
Right. What I'm sort of getting at, and I think you're getting at it too, is that your perspective from where you start the search, from where you go, follow your nose, is somehow different than healthcare consultants, healthcare academics, healthcare policymakers. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I think it's very different. I think that is what I'm trying to say, and I think the perspective of the book. Look, I'm a business person, so I run a movie theater chain. You know, when a soda is spilt on the floor, you've got rules and you've got procedures to make sure that's mopped up before someone slips and falls. The fact that hospitals have done a poor job of getting people to wash their hands to a business person seems strange. Where's the discipline? Where are the incentives? And it's asking a lot of those type of questions that really this book is about. Why is this thing such an island? What does it tell us about the big picture, what we see every day in our interactions with the system?
Now, my guess is also that when you set out on this research, it was, as you said, it was grief turned to obsession. How did the Atlantic cover story happen, and what was the response?
Well, that was that was, I think, a bit of an accident. I was very troubled by what happened with my dad. I was very troubled by that thought of 100,000 people dying that way. I basically spent a year writing an essay that made the argument that it was this lack of sort of normal discipline and incentives in the healthcare system that explained all of this stuff and that was all related. And that essay actually found its way into the hands of the managing editor of The Atlantic, James Bennett, who called me one day and said, "We've read your essay. Can we publish it?"
Wow.
So, and the reaction to it was fairly extraordinary, I think in part because it was really outside the political debate about healthcare. It was really saying something very different about healthcare than the politicians have. And I think one of the problems, you know, some people have reading the book is that we're now used to reading books as Democrats or Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a book that says the policies that both parties have pursued have taken us in this wrong direction, and the solutions both parties have come up with are probably no more than patches to a crumbling building. And so it doesn't get very excited about these extremely partisan fights we had about the Affordable Care Act or the prescription drug reform under the previous president. It's really not about politics. It really stands outside that debate and says, looking at the healthcare system more broadly and how it relates to the rest of society and, frankly, to health itself, what have we built? Can we fix it? I argue no. And if we can't fix it, what do we need to replace it with?
Okay. That's interesting, the reference you just made, because I'm going to return to that in a couple of minutes. But let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with David Goldhill. He's an entertainment industry executive, but based on personal experience and then a great deal of research, he's the author of Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. I often give out websites where people can learn more. You don't really have one, do you?
No, and I'm actually in a process of putting something together where I can start to collect people's stories.
Sure.
And comment together on what they mean about healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Right now, if someone wanted short of the book, which of course, you know, that'd be great by the book, I would say if you go to The Atlantic and put in David Goldhill, you'll get a link to the original article plus a couple of follow-up articles.
Yes, and there's a number of there's a number of pieces I've written as well on smaller aspects of this
right.
for Bloomberg and The Atlantic and some others.
Let me ask you this. So you're writing – you're doing the research because you feel the need to. You write the essay because you want to put this out in front of people. It becomes an Atlantic article as a big response. Why write a book?
Well, I asked myself that question for about a year. And I'm not sure I came up with the right answer as much as I felt there needed to be a broader sort of exploration of both really the fundamental issues and then ways to fix it. You know, the Atlantic article said something very unusual, which is let's not focus on the issues, let's focus on the political issues, let's focus on the fundamental incentives the industry has and try to fix those. And this book is more an explanation of how. It's also really an attempt to change the language of healthcare.
Mm.
You know, if you listen to the debates over the Affordable Care Act, and I'm perfectly willing to concede that I think the Obama administration's heart was in the right place, the debate itself tends to be constrained by the language of healthcare. And what this book tries to argue is, look, you know, one of the things we know is that spending a lot of money on healthcare is not the key to better health.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing in itself. And so if we're going to restrict ourselves to talking about healthcare in terms of healthcare, I think we're going to miss the broader issues, which is the extraordinary percentage of a young person's income that's going to have to support the system. It's roughly a quarter today and growing. The enormous amount of excess medicine that is causing real harm, again, particularly to our seniors, and a series of incentives in our public programs and in our private spending that takes money away from what we might think of as needed care or others might think of as needed care and favors care that at the moment is more profitable or higher volume or what have you, none of which necessarily, in fact, most of which is the opposite of better health. And so the book is about health more than healthcare and trying to change the language of healthcare so that instead of saying, as we do in healthcare, well, you know, if we did that, we wouldn't be able to afford this care and that's bad, really asking the question, is not being able to afford every single element of healthcare somebody in the system is willing to supply such a terrible thing if it improves our lives otherwise?
Yeah, no, exactly. I came across a quote of a doctor saying, you know, that longer life is not necessarily better life, you know, and that's one of the pieces that goes into what you're saying. One thing that I see in this, when you're talking about the language of the normal healthcare debates, the healthcare debate around Obamacare, which actually started kind of after your father's death and during your research period, if I'm not mistaken, is that the lobbyists, the money. Coming from the pharmaceutical industries, the medical device industries, the insurance industries, and the hospital industries actually has clouded the vision, if you will, that's a kind way of putting it, of anyone in the political domain or just about anyone except for some maverick to actually take the approach you're taking.
Oh, I think that's right. And one of the things the book argues, which I think is, you know, particularly important for liberals, is that whatever you think of the success of single-payer systems in other countries, and I have reasons to believe that those are under their own pressure. In fact, if we were having this discussion in any single-payer country, likely you'd be asking me about the sustainability of our system. But a lot of liberals think single-payer can resolve some of these problems, and I think when you look at our country with a very responsive political system that's very lobbyist-led, and you look at how something, as you point out, like the Affordable Care Act, was actually drafted, its real provisions, not its intention or political arguments, but what it actually says, you've got to recognize that the greater government role our government has in healthcare, it's almost inevitable, the greater amount of industry capture and industry influence. And one of the things I talk about in the book in trying to find an American way to do this is to recognize that if you look at Medicare and Medicaid, their incentives create a type of medicine that may not be what all of us think of as great healthcare. And a great part of that reason is the way our government works. You don't really have an independent process for determining rules and determining reimbursements. You can argue about it. You can dislike it. You can yell at the moon. But the reality is that is how our system works. And the more and more of healthcare decision-making we put at the government level, the more influence it's going to be by lobbying. We just saw in the last week alone word come out about the fiscal cliff bill that there are, you know, two special provisions that drive dialysis care and a type of radiation therapy, that were made by politicians, both of which, by the way, push up costs rather than push costs down. So one of the reasons the book is suspicious of how single pay would work here is exactly that point you make, that the degree of industry involvement and regulation here is much greater than in these other countries.
Yeah, sadly so. I mean, let me just give you a little background, David. I did a show on the 100,000 deaths, I'm guessing 10 or 12 years ago. You know, I've been looking at this for years, and as I say, this defense, pharmaceuticals, you name it. Every time it seems to come down to the capture of our government by money. And let me just put an analogy that has always come up for me. At one point, I was outside of the radio. I was working with some environmental organizations on waste control, right, landfills and so on. And what someone said that struck me as, boy, does this happen across the board, was that the big players in waste, whether it's waste management, Browning Ferris, those kind of folks, oppose regulation. When it becomes inevitable, they write it. And they write it in such a way that it works for them. And it seems to me that is what we see over and over again.
And I think it's inevitable in our system. So,
yeah.
Building a system that ignores that is pointless. There's a flip side to that as well, which is less about industry and more about the difficulties that government has regulating something as complex as healthcare. Many people may know that Medicare pays a lower reimbursement rate than private insurance for most services, and that Medicaid pays an even lower one, and these are required. And from the government's perspective, it's saving money. But when you look at the industry response, I think what we see in Medicare is that almost everybody has to take Medicare patients because there are so many of them, but you just package more services. So in other words, you make up for the lower reimbursement rate by, it's a crude word, but by selling patients more, which is one of the reasons we see things like one out of every three Medicare patients having surgery in their last year of life. In Medicaid, the reimbursement rates are so low that it looks like what happens is that Medicaid patients can get tons of relatively high volume procedures, where procedures can be done in high volumes profitably, relatively little of time-based therapy and care. And so that even there where the intentions are best and good and probably not influenced by lobbying, government policy that ignores how an industry is likely to react is one that's not going to drive the objectives that I think we all share, which is good care available for everybody.
Right. I had a statistic here actually on Medicare, and it was that the amount that 85% of Medicare is spent on 25% of patients. And much of that is, as you say, this end-of-life interventions that guarantee that some institutions are going to make money off that patient, whether it's going to improve their life or extend it. We're at the halfway point. Let me tell you, I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with David Goldhill, author of Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. Okay. David, I often or sometimes use a format that I call It's Broke, Let's Fix It, and it's three questions. The first question is, what's the evidence that it's broken? I don't think we have to deal with that question anymore. I think we've covered that. How did it get broken? What are the causes in the history? Let me throw that to you just for a brief bit, and then we'll focus on the solutions.
Well, I think the easiest thing to say, you know, would be a form of government policies that favored the insurance model over everything else. And I think insurance, in addition to being extraordinarily expensive, adds a lot of complexity to the system. But I think there's something else that most people don't focus on, which is that healthcare itself has changed. When insurance became the dominant way to pay for healthcare in other countries and then here, the assumption about what healthcare was is it was an emergency intervention to help somebody who's ill. What's happened over the last 50 years is that healthcare itself has changed, so that there's far more of it is now about managing lifestyle issues where issues that used to be thought of as lifestyle issues are now thought of as medical issues. A lot of preventive care, a lot of long-term care, a lot of things that really resemble more other services we have in our life, and less, you know, what I would call the fighting fires model of healthcare. When you hear politicians talk about healthcare, they say things like, you know, when you get sick, you need help, you can't afford it, we're there to pay for it. In fact, that idea of healthcare is less and less a share of what our spending is and what care is, and even more important, less related to what healthcare is likely to be in the future. So while we can talk about how the system we've created broke it, what's really interesting is how care itself, I think, has made our political view, and this is not just true of the United States, so anachronistic that the demand for healthcare really no longer fits the political model we've gotten so used to.
Mm. And then let me just add, because I know it's in there in the history, is that the whole notion of linking health insurance to your employer is a fluke. And you pointed out, but for anyone who doesn't know this, you know, now it's just sort of like the sun rises, the sun sets. People just accept it as reality. During World War II, when there were wage and price controls and a shrunk labor market because so many people were serving in the armed services, what could an employer do to get the best remaining employees that were available? And they decided, oh, we can make we can differentiate ourselves by our benefits. And health care insurance and that sort of thing became a piece of that. We come out of World War II, no longer that necessity, and it just perpetuates itself.
And we don't even think anymore about how weird it is that we use our health care insurance to pay for things we planned months in advance, the things we're using all that. It would be as if our homeowner's insurance didn't just cover the house burning down, but covered the furniture going out of style and the utilities.
That's interesting. Okay, so we've covered a bit of the how is it broken? How did it get broken? Let me, before I go to how do we fix it, or this is in the ballpark of how do we fix it. I assume that once you begin this pursuit and you start looking for solutions, and I would say the solution to some extent is not merely how do I keep terrible things from happening to someone like my father in the hospital, but more, how do we change the incentives? How do we change the accountability? I imagine that you looked a lot at other countries because they basically we are number one in expense, and you know, depending on the research, much and the particular thing you're looking at, but much lower among advanced countries, advanced industrialized economies. In performance. So I assume you went out and looked at other countries. What did you learn? You ended up saying, you didn't adopt any of their single payer systems, but what did you learn?
Well, I think you learned a couple things. One is that almost every country is having difficulty figuring out how to pay for healthcare. Even in the systems that seem best at discipline and growth, there's an issue with what you do as a population gets older.
It's demographics a lot, right?
Demographics and also look, almost every country on earth says some form of, if you need it, we will pay for it. And the industry has responded by expanding the definition of need so that we all need, you know, all populations, Western populations, are far healthier now than they were 40, 50 years ago. But we all need a lot more health care. And as long as any system says...
Wait, let me just ask something about what you just said. You just said all Western countries are healthier than they were 40, 50 years ago.
Far more.
What about the obesity epidemic, the diabetes epidemic, those things we hear about all the time?
Yes. Well, there are certainly things that there are certainly things that may shorten our lives, but lifespans have increased in most of the Western countries by 7 to 10 years over the last three generations. The reason for that isn't healthcare, though.
No.
The reason for that is income and nutrition and giving up smoking and drinking less and being in fewer dangerous jobs and lower homicide rates. These are actually the things that drive mortality. I mean, one of the things is people say, well, the U.S. spends so much on healthcare and performs poorly on mortality. Mortality has almost nothing to do with healthcare at this point.
In America, it has a great deal to do with homicide, which would be another program on gun control, perhaps.
Well, the interesting thing is a lot of the other social priorities we've cut back on to pay for more health care, whether it's, you know, in the public sector, whether it's environment or recreation or support for lower income people, you know, has been crowded out by spending more and more on health care in the private sector as well. Right? We really don't have any reason to believe that spending more money on health care will make people healthier than giving everybody an extra week vacation and reducing the stress levels. So one of the things about the healthcare debate is the more and more resources we pour into healthcare, almost certainly the less healthy we would be than we otherwise would have been.
And I do want to emphasize, because that was a subtle point that I saw in your work, which is, and I'm going to read a quote from you, by what mechanism does society determine that an extra $100 billion for healthcare will make us healthier than $10 billion for cleaner air or water, $25 billion for better nutrition, $5 billion for parks, $10 billion for recreation, and $50 billion in additional vacation time? That is so potent to me that we – and again, I look also at defense. You know, another thing that just – they both seem to – you know, we just open it up and let the meter run on both of those. And in fact, every time that happens, we're failing to – By omission, we are making a choice, and we are choosing against these other goods for all of our citizens.
And even, Terrence, even experts who support the current system say 25 to 30% of the money is wasted. Well, that's $500-700 billion. And if you imagine $500-700 billion a year going into any other social priority, any, it's hard to imagine the impact on our population's health and well-being wouldn't be much greater.
Right. Oh, by the way, just because I said we'd go back to it, I'm just going to jump on this one and then we'll return. But you had mentioned Atul Gawande's article on checklists, and then he wrote a book called The Checklist Manifesto. And what that was that he looked at the airline industry, for instance, and saw that for years they have had a checklist that they do before – we all know this – before they take off. And that's because there's life and death at stake. And yet healthcare did not have it. They found that you may have the statistics more at hand than I do, but they found that when hospitals do institute a checklist prior to surgery, that the errors and lives and the savings are enormous. And yet you were saying there was resistance either from hospitals or from surgeons who, you know, this is an imposition. I will tell you one statistic that I found interesting was that the statistic on if you were a surgeon, did you want to use this checklist was down, I'm going to make up a number, but just bear with me, 40 or 50%. The question of if you were in surgery, Dr. Surgeon, would you like the surgeon who's doing your surgery to have the checklist? It was 93%.
Well, you know, one of the best indicators of safety in a hospital is to poll the nurses as to whether they would be willing to have a loved one treated there. It correlates almost perfectly with safety data.
Sure. So I just wanted to – by the way, and I recommend the book, The Checklist Manifesto, as something to look at. Okay. Let's turn to your solution.
So, Terrence, to talk about solutions, you have to start with Becky, who's a 23-year-old who started work for my company a couple years – was 23 when she started a couple years ago at a salary of $35,000 in New York City. If you look at if you assume Becky is the prime breadwinner for her family, and you look at how much money Becky is going to contribute into the healthcare system over her lifetime, assuming costs grow only at the estimates under the Affordable Care Act, in other words, assuming the Affordable Care Act is as successful as it thinks it's going to be in controlling costs, when you look at all the ways Becky's going to put in money into the healthcare system, she's going to put in $1.9 million over her lifetime. She's not rich, and she never gets sick. That's what we assume in doing that analysis.
Now, and you're going to break that out a little bit for us because
– Well, the bulk of it is actually money she's not aware she's putting in.
That's what I want people to hear.
Yeah. Of that amount of money, roughly 30% she knows is healthcare payments. So it's her share of insurance. It's her out-of-pocket. It's her Medicare premiums when she's 65. But the bulk of it is things that Becky doesn't realize that she's contributing. She thinks someone else is, or she's not aware of their healthcare costs. That include the insurance premiums that her employer pays, which, of course, ultimately comes out of her paycheck. An employer has only so much to pay Becky in compensation, and if I got to pay it for health insurance, I can't pay it in salary. Republican, Democrat, left, right, every economist on earth knows this is the case and agrees. Over time, these massive increases in insurance paid by your employer was money that you would have had in salary. A lot of it goes through the tax system. A significant amount of her federal income tax and her state income tax now goes to fund the healthcare system. If you start with that assumption that Becky's looking at $1.9 million and she's not going to be a rich person, and fortunately she's not sick in this analysis, either case she pays a lot more, you realize that what our healthcare system is best at right now is disguising from every American the extraordinary amount of money we're putting into this. And it's almost, there's very, very few families on earth in this country that we would project to use anywhere near that amount of healthcare over a lifetime. Yet the entire system is based on the idea that all of us need help. And in fact, in the book, I interview Becky. Becky expects to be rich because she's young, ambitious, and smart. But she says even if she got really rich, she can't imagine having to pay for her whole health care. It really tells you something about this mass delusion if someone thinks they're going to be rich and even they're going to need help. I don't know where the help's supposed to come from.
Right, exactly. You make a pie chart and you say, okay, here you are. Here's you and your other wealthy friends. It just doesn't add up.
But we all believe it. We all believe that without help, we can't pay for our health care. And the real reason is we don't know how much we're putting in. Almost every American is putting an extraordinary amount of money, probably more than for any other expense over their lives, into our healthcare system. When you start with that, and only if you start with that, you realize you have a lot of flexibility to build a different system. What I think we need in healthcare is we need healthcare to look more like the rest of the economy, where you've got providers that are genuinely responsive to chasing, competing for customers. Now, the argument you always get is, oh my God, I get hit by a bus, I can't negotiate price. But that's not really what happens on the mainland. That's real island thinking. On the mainland, providers are competing to be the low price provider. There is no one competing to be the low price provider in healthcare because there's no benefit for it. What we need to do is tow the island back to the mainland and run as much of the enormous amount of money we're spending on healthcare back through individuals. There's a lot of different ways to get there. There are ways to get there that everybody has the same amount. There are ways to get there that everybody has some. But just to give you a sense of how much money is out there, the federal government this year will spend $850 billion on Medicaid and subsidizing Medicare. If you took the $850 billion, you could give a health grant of $8,500 a year to 100 million Americans. So what you got to start with in terms of rethinking the system is to recognize that one of the things we all believe, that none of us have enough money to pay for health care, is just false. It's just not true. We're, in fact, spending so much on administrative costs and complexity and ridiculous prices, there's plenty of money.
Well, wait a minute. Let me get that straight. You're saying we all have the assumption that we cannot afford our health care expenses during our lifetime. And yet you say that actually, we could. But what you're doing there, I assume, is you're saying, let's see what's really your health care.
Well, what I would say is let's divide health care into two parts. Let's talk about those things that are truly insurable. And things that are insurable are rare, major, and unpredictable. I would like to see...
Well, let me ask a question there. Rare, major, unpredictable. Would you also add perhaps predictable... either they're chronic conditions for which the treatment would be expensive relative to people's income, or those towards the end of life that aren't so – I don't believe they're so rare. So tell me about that.
Well, so the interesting things about that is essentially every person will have at least one chronic condition diagnosed over their lifetime. There's nothing rare about it. There are obviously some that are a lot more serious than others. I have a chronic condition. I manage my cholesterol with a statin, as do, I think, now a majority of American men over 40. You know, whether that should be an insurable event if every single person does it, or whether we're not better off having a truly competitive market for statins, I would probably aim towards the latter. And part of it is this takes time, right? Right now, all of us are relying on an insurance system to fund everything. What I'd like to see, actually, is have the insurance system shrink so that it covers only catastrophic. And by the way, I actually think it's a proper function of government to provide that insurance on a cradle-to-grave, no underwriting basis. We all should be entitled, because it's what we all believe, to protection for those things that are rare, major, and catastrophic.
Okay.
I think a lot of the dysfunction we see in the system is having a non-competitive insurance market that doesn't, in fact, cover us cradle-to-grave, that for some reason we need to change every time we change a job or at a stage of life. That creates a lot of the complexity and anguish we have in our insurance-based system.
So do I hear you saying that for those major, rare, catastrophic, et cetera, that category, that it would be a single-payer system?
Well, I wouldn't be single-payer. I'd be single-funder, which is different. I just think the government does a very poor job of buying health care. I think what we need is more of a traditional insurance system there. Because I think as long as the patient isn't the customer, we're going to see things like what happened to my father and what happens at every stage in a hospital for someone who's seriously ill, which is you have an incredibly complicated system facing the patient at the time of life they're most vulnerable. A lot of people, I think, hope that, gee, the government will fix that. The government's smarter than I am. The government's better than I am. But in fact, in every other market on earth, every other industry on earth, every other service on earth, what we see is the competition for patient customers that drives real quality and real accountability. You know, you mentioned Atul before. He's written a lot about the problem of a lack of transparency in healthcare.
Oh, absolutely.
And that lack of transparency exists because of the government's role.
Well, wait, but couldn't that be fixed without – I mean, I'm just asking. Couldn't that be – it seems to me we have a lot of things that are being done poorly – And they're all pieces of this. So couldn't transparency be enacted tomorrow?
I know a lot of people believe it can. This is not exactly a new idea. And if it's again about being realistic about how our system works, about a month ago, CMS, which is the agency that runs Medicare, decided to reduce public reporting of what is known as never events, which are the things that hospitals do, like amputating on the wrong limb, that should never happen, that in fact happen a lot of times. So
you're saying that actually they reduced the reporting. Now, is that the reporting that has to be done by those where the event takes place, or the making public of that once reported?
Well, it changing the form of the former, and then more importantly, changing the availability of the data. It's a point you raised before. In airline safety, if there's a crash, we have a commitment to a public, transparent process to understand what went wrong. And everybody's involved, right, from the manufacturer to the airline to the unions to the government. The government doesn't know the airlines. The government's not a single payer. The government's role can be more of an effective regulator. Unfortunately, I think in the healthcare system in our country, the deeper the government is as a true payer, as a true buyer of services, the less likely you are to get the rigorous regulatory process I think this industry really needs.
And that goes back to the thing we said before, that the more the government is Scrooge McDuck, the guy with all the money, the more the industries will capture them.
Well, I assume a lot of your listeners were very engaged in the debate over the Affordable Care Act. But I guarantee there's a handful of congressmen, much less listeners, who are aware of the real details of a lot of the regulations and rules which were designed to protect business models or protect particular providers. It's just too complicated. I think if you want real safety in healthcare, you got to get to the point where there's a billboard that says, go to Uptown Hospital because Downtown Hospital will kill you.
Right. So what you're saying is transparency and citizen information, buyer awareness and so on is a huge plus that makes it more like other industries. And the assumption someone might say, well, then the government should do that. And what you're saying is, but wait, look at the way our government and big finance and very wealthy industries end up comporting themselves. It'd be nice if that could happen, but that's not going to happen. And let's find another way.
And I think the government is more likely to be effective where its role is better defined and where the competitive instinct in the industry makes it more likely that competitors will fight on things that we care about, like safety and quality.
So on these points of transparency and so on, any good models in other countries?
Well, it's transparency is one that's a problem in a lot of places. I think the reality is there aren't good models there. And it's one of the reasons I think that, for all of the faith that people have that the government can fix this problem, it gets more difficult the closer the government is to actually providing health care to expect they're going to offer the type of transparency they need.
But is that true? I was saying, is that true in other countries as well?
I couldn't answer for every other country.
Okay.
I just don't have enough information.
Right.
I haven't seen a system where transparency isn't an issue raised, but it may be that I just don't know enough of the other ones.
I mean, because the thing I go to is, the studies that have been done about other countries, the one that I have close at hand is Canada, right? In Canada, there were 10 big meta studies and so on, and they looked at cost and effectiveness, and they found much lower cost, much more effectiveness. Is that because they're less captured, or is it because Canadians are more polite and ethical? I mean, what is going on there?
Well, I think it's one of the benefits of a single-payer system is that you have an absolute budget. You can't go over the budget, which means you can't provide excess care.
Ah.
And so I think that is a very important benefit of single-payer. One of the issues we have with Medicare in this country is Medicare is an entitlement. It's the opposite of a budgeted item. The more services people need, the more Medicare spends.
Mm.
The industry responds by finding lots more services for your...
Well, as you pointed out, the way they make up for the lower payments per service is they overprescribe, and since the customer, in this case, as you point out, is Medicare and not the patient, that gap results in these sorts of things. I'll tell you what, we've got about a minute and a half. And what I want you to do is make whatever closing statement you want to make. My intention in this, David, was to get people kind of in the middle of it. I didn't think we'd have all the answers, but to let people see some of the questions. And if you will, as I said before, you're not a consultant, a healthcare consultant. You're not a bureaucrat. You're looking at this through new eyes, and I hope that our conversation has let people see, I've had a lot of listeners going, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I'd want to end then with a quick story, which is I took my son for an appendectomy a month ago, an emergency, obviously. He went to see a pediatric surgeon. We had to fill out an 8-page form before the surgeon would see us. He saw us, wanted to get a confirmatory ultrasound, sent us to the ultrasound in the same hospital 4 floors down. My son's doubled over in pain. We had to fill out the exact same 8-page form.
Oh, my God.
We then had a 5-hour wait for an operating room, in part because operating rooms were kept track of on a whiteboard, which is a technology I haven't really seen for something like that in 30 or 40 years.
Right. Our local car repair does not do it that way.
And then he needed, because it was so delayed, he needed a prescription painkiller. It took an hour and a half to fill the prescription, despite the fact that the pharmacy was on the same floor, roughly 50 feet away. What I would urge listeners to do is rather than say, well, that's healthcare. Healthcare is different. We're lucky to have all these healthcare benefits. I'd ask your listeners to ask a question I asked, which is, are we just effectively giving this a pass because we think we're not paying for it and someone else is?
That's right. A, we think we don't understand it. And B, we think, as you pointed out with Becky, we think the money's coming from somewhere.
And 50 years ago, nobody, there's a couple thousand people who knew how to use a computer. The reason we all use them now and carry them in our pockets is because somebody could make a living by making it easy for us. In healthcare, no one has the incentives to make things cheap, easy, even safe for us. And
okay.
That, I think, is fundamentally what's dangerous. We've got to change those incentives.
Very good. Again, the book is Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. And you can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. For podcasts, articles, and transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcnally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement that tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally, TEMCNALLY, at mac.com. Finally, thank you to David Goldhill. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, David.